The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus and the Forgotten Legacy, is the fifth of a 16-part series from Yavna to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Eliezer ben Yaakov and Leah bas Mordechai Aleihem HaShalom, Louis and Lillian Lipnick of blessed memory.
One of the most extraordinary personalities of the time covered in this series from Yavne to Beitar was Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, known as Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, the Great. Despite a very late start in learning and much difficulties, he emerged as the outstanding scholar of his time. His story, his successes, his struggles, his disappointments is the subject of tonight's lecture. If you turn to page one, the early story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is described in several sources. They are basically one and the same story, but there are slight differences. I've chosen the version Obus de Rabbi Nosson. It's from the sixth chapter. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus did not start off as a great scholar. In fact, he was already 22 years old, and according to another version of the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, he was 28 years old. And he was totally unlearned. He did not know how to daven, to pray. He did not know how to bench, to say Birchas HaMazon, grace after meals. He did not know how to say Kriya Shema. But he had this tremendous urge to learn. And he tried to convey it to his father without much results. In fact, the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says that his father replied to him when he told his father about his wish to go and study Torah. He says, "You're 28 years old. It's too late to start." He says, "Get married, have a family." He says, "Your kids will learn. But for you, it's too late." And he wasn't satisfied. According to the version that we'll be reading now, he was 22 years old, Novus Rav Nosson, he already was married. We can start reading. This is, what was the beginning of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus' development? He was 22 years old, and he had not yet learned Torah. One day he made up his mind and said, "I shall go and learn Torah from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai." One has to realize Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the leading scholar of his time. For someone who's totally unlearned, to have the desire to learn by the greatest scholar of his time showed tremendous vision on his part, that he felt that he would be someone, despite his the paucity of his background, that he would be somebody who would eventually be worthy of being of Zakkai's disciple. On that day when he made that decision, his father, and evidently he told his father, His father replied, says, you will not eat, and says, I'm not going to feed you until you plow a complete furrow. Like Masach Nitnarish, in other words, don't waste your time about these dreams of becoming a scholar. So we have a family farm, and everyone has to lend a hand, and you have to plow with the rest of us. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus got up early in the morning. We only spoke to him at night. He woke up early in the morning. He plowed the required amount, and it was Erev Shabbos. I didn't want to go home. Rabbi Eliezer went and ate by his father-in-law. According to this version, he already was married. According to the other version, he was not. Some say he ate nothing from the 6 hours of Erev Shabbos until 6 hours after Shabbos. In other words, he had made up his mind, and he started going towards Yerushalayim. While he was traveling along the way, he saw a stone or a clod of earth that looked like some sort of food matter, decayed food matter, and took it and put it in his mouth. Actually, it was not food. I think it was the dropping of cattle, because he had nothing to eat, plus he had this terrible stench that was coming from his mouth from eating this non-food. And he went and stayed in an inn, went to Yerushalayim, began to learn before Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in Yerushalayim. So the version we have in Avos Reb Noson says, until a foul odor emanated from his mouth. The Medrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer has it a little differently. He came before Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked him, what kind of a family do you come from? He didn't want to say. He didn't want to say he was Hyrcanus' son. Hyrcanus evidently was from a very esteemed family. It was well recognized. And it is interesting to note that even though this Hyrcanus seems to have been a person of renown, he didn't educate his children, which is quite remarkable and gives us an insight to the period. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked him what he had learned, and he told him nothing. And he asked him, did he know how to daven, to know how to pray, to say Shema, to say grace after meals, to bench? And he said no. So the first thing Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did was to teach him how to live like a Jew. In other words, to pray, to say Kriya Shema. And Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Eliezer responded, he was crying. He says, what are you sad about? He says, I want to learn Torah. I just don't want to know the minimal way how to function as a Jew. I want to be a scholar. So he taught, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai taught Rabbi Eliezer two halachas, two laws. He told him, go over them and come back tomorrow. And he had studied them. He came back, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai took the time. And as we're dealing, he was teaching a neophyte, even though his students were the greatest scholars. There's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's other students, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, the greatest minds and greatest scholars of his time. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai took the time with Rabbi Eliezer. And some 8 days passed. And he wasn't eating. I mean, he had just, and all he had was the stench was coming from his mouth. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai felt it, and he says, my son says, have you eaten today? And Rabbi Eliezer was quiet. He repeated his question. There was silence. Thereupon Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai called the innkeeper, as the one who's by whom he was staying, and asked if Rabbi Eliezer had eaten there. And he said, he didn't eat by it. I thought he was eating by the Rebbe. As I thought he was eating by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I thought he was eating by you. Between both of us, we almost lost Rabbi Eliezer. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai comforted Rabbi Eliezer and said, just as a foul odor emanated from your mouth, so shall a good name in Torah emanate from you. And that was the beginning of someone who was determined to learn from the best. And he kept on learning until he became on par with the other students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I'm going to turn page 2. Hyrcanus, his father, heard that he was learning Torah of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And as this version simply says, I shall go and disinherit Eliezer, my son. Rashi, in his commentary on the Medrash Bereishis Rabbah, in the beginning of chapter 42, in Perek Mem Beis, explains that based on the internal readings of the Medrash, that as Hyrcanus was getting older and some years had passed, the sons felt it was unfair that the son should do all the work. Eliezer had abandoned them and gone to learn Torah in Yerushalayim, the yeshiva. And it was not fair that Eliezer should eventually get a portion of the inheritance equal to the brothers that were working. And the children of Hyrcanus prevailed on their father that their father should disinherit Rabbi Eliezer. So he wanted, it was a legal procedure, he wanted to know to do it right, and he decided to go up to Yerushalayim to Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai to have it officially, to have his son officially disinherited because he had abandoned the family to study Torah. Which again gives us an insight to the period of that day, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was speaking to Yerushalayim, as he was scheduled to speak, and all the great men of Israel sat before him. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai had heard about evidently a request that this Hyrcanus had made for an appointment and about disinheriting his son. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai wanted to show Hyrcanus what kind of a son he really had. So the first thing Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai did was gave orders that when Hyrcanus walks through the door, and evidently they knew who he was, that he shouldn't get a seat. That all the seats in the back, he should be excluded from any seats in the back. So as he started coming in, they told him there's some room in the front. So they kept on pushing him forward till he got to the front row. And he sat with would be the greatest, the greatest gevirim, the greatest parnosim, the greatest caretakers of the Jewish community. This was Nachdiman ben Gurion, ben Kalba Savua, ben Tzitzis HaKesis. He sat with the greats of that generation. He settled, felt a little uncomfortable. I mean, he was a man of means, but he wasn't a billionaire, you know, so he was, felt a little uncomfortable. And evidently by the fact that he was sitting amongst people that were quite learned. It was said that day Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai turned towards Rabbi Eliezer and said, "Speak, Rabbi Eliezer, I want you to say." And he said, "I can't." Rabbi Yochanan persisted and the other students pressured him. And as the Officer of Nosson says, he stood and spoke words the likes of which have never been heard. And every word that came forth from his mouth, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai stood on his feet and kissed him on his head, said, "Rabbi Eliezer," as he called him, "my Rebbe, you have taught me the truth." And here's the you can imagine the scene. Here is the father that's ready to disinherit his son. And he sees all this tremendous honor, the kovet, that the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the most esteemed person of his generation, is giving his son. Hyrcanus stood on his feet and said, "I've come to disinherit my son Eliezer. Now all my possessions are given to Eliezer, my son, and his brothers have nothing." Evidently he felt that he had been betrayed by his children, and he didn't realize what kind of a son he really had in Eliezer. The Medrash Rabbah continues on that Rabbi Eliezer's reply to his father was that just as you, says, I disavow any other portion besides the one that I should normally have as part of the inheritance. I don't want to gain at my brother's expense. And this was the beginning of Rabbi Eliezer. We have, from material we have in the Talmud, we have again some, besides this incident, what was the daily life of Rabbi Eliezer? What kind of a person did he develop into? And here on page 2b, if you could look at the whole paragraph, but in the middle of the first paragraph, he just described what kind of a life he led. He says, "During all my life, this is no man was earlier than myself in the study hall, because he was always the first one to come in. I never slept or dozed in the study hall." This he said later in his life. "Nor did I ever leave a person in the study hall when I went out. Nor did I ever utter mundane speech, nor have I ever in my life said a thing which I have not heard from my teachers." He was well known, and this is if you didn't see the beginning of the paragraph. He was well known, for he felt his place was to be a conduit for the Torah of the previous generation. He didn't want to develop new lines of thought, but he felt his role was that as a preserver of the old. They said about his Rabbi Yochanan Zakka, Rabbi Eliezer's teacher, that during his whole lifetime, again we've covered this before, he never uttered mundane talk. Never walked 4 cubits, 4 amos, without Torah, nor without tefillin. Nor was any man earlier than he in the study hall. Nor did he sleep or doze in the study hall. Nor did he think in Torah in filthy alleyways. Nor did anyone ever find him sitting in silence, but only sitting and learning. No one but himself ever opened the doors to his disciples, unless he was the first one in and opened the doors in the morning. He never in his life said anything which he had not heard from his teacher. This is also Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. And except on the eve of Passover and the eve of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, he never said it's time to arise from the studies of the study hall. He always encouraged his students to keep on studying. And so did his disciple Rabbi Eliezer conduct himself after him. And this, not only did he preserve Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's Torah, Rabbi Eliezer preserved the way he lived. There's an interesting medrash, just to give us another inkling into the life of Rabbi Eliezer. But before we begin this medrash, just to share with you an interesting statement that I once heard. Rabbi Eliezer was always the first one to enter the Beis HaMedrash, the study hall in the morning, the last one to leave. If you ever opened up a Mishnayos, the first Tana, the first authority mentioned in the Mishnah is Rabbi Eliezer. That's in Brachas. The last Masichta, the last tractate, is Uktzin. And the last person mentioned is Rabbi Eliezer. He was the first one in the Beis HaMedrash. He was the first one in the Mishnah. He was the last one out. He was the last mentioned in the Mishnah. Uktzin has an addendum that was written after the time of the Mishnah, you know, which was part really from the period of the Talmud. But from the original Mishnah, he is the last one mentioned by name. There's a fascinating medrash here on page 3. And it says, when Moshe went up to the upper world to receive the Torah, And one has to know about this is meant to be literal, taken literally, or it's an allegory. He heard the voice of the Holy One, blessed be he, who was sitting and involving himself with a section of the Torah dealing with the red heifer, with the poor Aduma. He was stating the halacha in the name of the author, as he was learning, and said, Rabbi Eliezer says, as he saw, Moshe Rabbeinu, according to this medrash, saw a vision that Hashem is saying over the Mishnah that was about to be composed, mentioning Rabbi Eliezer. Eliezer starts the Mishnah in Purah, the section which deals with Purah Aduma. It says, a calf's age is defined as being within 1 year, and a cow, Purah, is defined as being within 2 years. In fact, Rabbi Eliezer is mentioned more in Purah, in the tractate dealing with the red heifer, more than any other single Tana. He's mentioned 19 times. And Moshe said in his presence, Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, may it be your will that he, Eliezer ben Hurkanus, shall be one of my descendants. He replied, by your life he will be one of your descendants. And it seems, from another source, it seems that Rabbi Eliezer was a Levi. He received Maaser. There's a medrash to that effect. There, according to the major commentator, Rav David Luria, on the Medrash Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, he explains that there was, in a sense, to Rabbi Eliezer and to his students, the ones that followed him, there was a certain insight into the whole parsha of Purah Aduma, this red heifer, one of the most difficult sections. It's called Chukas HaTorah, that section of the Torah that really is, in a certain sense, beyond normal human understanding. And in a certain sense, Rabbi Eliezer was gifted with an insight into Purah Aduma, which even Moshe Rabbeinu, even Moses, was not given. And perhaps there's an allusion in this medrash that he was so impressed, and it's not clear why he was just impressed by the defining of the years. It's this year and that year, and evidently there's more to this than meets the eye. But it seems that this Rabbi Eliezer, a descendant of Moses himself, was destined to uncover or to be given an insight that was even beyond what was given to Moshe himself. Imagine, you know, if we look at this, what became of Rabbi Eliezer? Imagine if he had listened to his father. And he said, yeah, you know, that's a little too old for me to start learning Torah. You know, 28, 22. It's, you know, I'll raise a family and I'll teach them Torah. How much poorer we would be today. After all, Rabbi Akiva, the famous Rabbi Akiva, was a disciple of Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Akiva was the teacher of Klal Yisrael. You know, there's a very cute little story that's told, that a Rav came to a balabos, someone who was a fine person, and the Rav asked him, when do you learn Torah? So he says, you know, I'm too busy to learn Torah, but you know, I'm giving my kids a good education, you know, and Mirat Hashem, one day they'll be learning Torah. But it so happens, after his kids go to yeshiva, they go into business like their father did. And the Rav, again, the next generation, asked them, you know, when are you going to be learning Torah? He says, you know, it's hard for me, times are tough, but I'm going to give my kid an education, and he's going to be learning Torah. You know, and the Rav had gefragt, avur del kind, you know, where is that final product going to come? Because after all, says,
a person has to try to seize the opportunity himself. Of course, you have to give it to your, you have to instill in your children. But it's hard for the children to grow up what they can grow up to be if they don't see parents that are the models of that. So it's just very interesting to see the life of Rabbi Eliezer, that he didn't want to have this vicarious life through his children. He wanted to do it himself. How much richer every one of us here today is because of it. We find here on page 3, the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as the scribes, had 5 primary students. According to the major version, the first version, Rabbi Eliezer was the greatest. And his special power, special gift, was his memory. He said, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is like a cemented cistern that loses not a drop. And if all the sages of Israel were on one pan of a balance scale, Eliezer ben Hyrcanus were on the other, he would outweigh them all. There's an alternate opinion of Abba Shoal, but this is the main opinion. Not only was he gifted in Torah, but you see on page 4, it was important that the Sanhedrin, that at least some members of the Sanhedrin, be acquainted with all 70 languages. Jews were far flung in literally almost every country of the world. The Sanhedrin was the central body to resolve disputes and questions. And it was important that the members of the Sanhedrin be able to communicate and to understand Jews from all over the world. Rabbi Eliezer was one of those few people who knew all the languages the Jews spoke all over. And not only was he, we find this is unusual, midah is unusual, his knowledge. In fact, there's a medrash, Gracious Rabbah, that says even in matters of Kabbalah, he was an authority of his time. And he taught Rabbi Akiva. But in his piety, in his tzitkis, he was unusual. Here on page 4, in paragraph F, we had we quoted part of this Yerushalmi, and we studied Shmuel HaKotan. But there was an incident which the elders went up to an attic in Yavne. As we've explained before, that Yavne was the seat of the Sanhedrin even before the temple was destroyed. Where a bas kol, a voice from heaven, went out and said, there are 2 amongst you that are fit to receive communication from the divine spirit. Shmuel HaKotan is one of them. Shmuel HaKotan was still alive then. They gazed their eyes at Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus as being the most likely other that was singled out. So here we've developed a picture now of the kind of life Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus made for himself. I'd like to share with you just a very other interesting facet of his life. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked his students, what they felt was the most important character trait to develop. Rabbi Eliezer's response was Ayin Tova, a good eye. The idea of not being jealous of the fortune of others. He was a tolerant, and he felt that tolerance and fagina name it, so in other words, that you're happy with the joys that others experience was a prime attribute to work on. It's very interesting to note that in his own life, that money, in other words, the acquiring wealth, didn't have a central place in his life. He is the author of the statement, as the Gemara in Bava Basra, on Yud Amud Beis, in 10b, that says, he who wants to merit having male children, in other words, children that will carry on the family, what should he do? Like the family's name should be continued. Yefazer Mamoina Laniyim. He should distribute his money to the poor. There was an incident that's recorded in Gemara in Brachos in Mem Zayin Amud Beis in 47b that they were lacking someone for a minyan. And Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus had a slave. A slave is not kosher to be part of the minyan. But he freed him. So by freeing him, he was a free man already. He was a freed slave. After he was a slave, an Eved Kanani undergoes a quasi-conversion. When he is freed, at that point, the slave is eligible, I mean, is a regular Jew. Rabbi Eliezer freed his slave, so he should have a tenth for a minyan. You know, slaves cost money in those days. It was a lot of money. As Rabbi David Luria, the major commentator on Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, points out, evidently you see that for him a mitzvah was worth a lot more than the money of the slave. In addition, Rabbi Eliezer is the author of the well-known statement, it's a Gemara in Sota, Mem Ches Amud Beis in 48b. The Mishiei Shloi Hayoim. If you have money today, you have some. V'oimer says, "Man noichal lamocha." What are we going to eat tomorrow? Says, I have enough for today, but you're worried. Says, of course, I mean, we're not saying you don't make the steps of trying to make a parnosa, but he says, "What am I going to have tomorrow?" How is emuchusori amona? He's lacking faith. You know, we have to make a shtadlus, we have to do. But after you've done everything, the notion that my parnosa is in Hashem's hands, is central to being a Jew. And Rabbi Eliezer taught us that. So just interesting, you know, here's a person, Rabbi Eliezer, as we traced his background, who gave up everything. He gave up his father's fortune. He didn't eat. To him, learning Torah, growing spiritually, was the most important thing in his life. It's just interesting that those values, which he felt are right and reflect the real Torah values, are things that he taught and he lived in his own life. But Rabbi Eliezer was not just a scholar. One in the yeshiva, just a student. He was a teacher as well. Here on page 4 of section 2, Rabbi Eliezer had evidently a Beis Din. He had a court of law at a yeshiva in Lud. And the Talmud explains that the commandment tzedek tzedek tirdof, that you should follow justice, and make sure that when you're going to have a case adjudicated, that it's done by the most fair and most accomplished scholars. She says, "Holach acha chachomim li yeshiva." If you want to know truth, go to the scholars in the yeshiva. Go to Rabbi Eliezer Lelud. He's the first one. There's a long list in Lud, and it's right near where the airport is located today, and in Israel. That's where his yeshiva was. You have a question, halacha, you want to know, do the right thing, go to Rabbi Eliezer. And the Medrash in Shir HaShirim describes the base Medrash of Rabbi Eliezer. This is the study hall of Rabbi Eliezer in Lud was as large as a ris. It was like something like 400 feet long. He had a lot of students. There was a stone there that was designated for his seat. And once Rabbi Yeshua came in and began to kiss that stone, he said, "This stone is like Mount Sinai." And the one who sat on it, it would seem that he said it after Rabbi Eliezer's death, is like the Ark of the Covenant. This is Oren HaBris. It housed the Torah itself. It housed the Ten Commandments. There's a fascinating incident which gives us a glimpse of the times, not only Rabbi Eliezer as the scholar and as the teacher, but Rabbi Eliezer, a different facet of Rabbi Eliezer's life. Once, this is on page 5, Rabbi Eliezer was arrested. And the language of the Gemara is because of minus. And according to the Rach, according to Rabbeinu Hananel, there was suspicion of being a Christian. This could very well be in the time that Nero persecuted the Christians. You know, Nero claimed that Rome burned down because of the Christians. And he was accused, Rabbi Eliezer, of being a Christian. At least that is how Rabbeinu Hananel learns. And they brought him to the tribune to be judged. And the governor said to him, "How could a man, a sage man like you, says, occupy yourself with such idle things, things of no consequence?" And he replied, "You know, I acknowledge the judge is right." The governor thought that Rabbi Eliezer was referring to the governor, and he took it as a compliment. Rabbi Eliezer was referring in his mind to Hashem, his Father in heaven. And the judge said, "Because you've acknowledged me as right, I swear in the name of mercy that you're to be acquitted." Rabbi Eliezer was was visibly shaken by the incident, that why should he be accused of being a Christian? And when he came home, his disciples called on him to console him, but he wouldn't accept any consolation. And Rabbi Akiva said to him, perhaps Rabbi Akiva knew the real details, and he said, "Master, permit me to say one thing of what you've taught me." And Rabbi Eliezer replied, "Speak." He says, "Master, perhaps some of the teachings of the Minim have been transmitted to you." In other words, you've studied Christian literature or thought, and you approved of it. And because of that, you were arrested. There's a Gemara in Moed Katan, Yud Ches Amud Beis, in 18b. This is generally when someone is suspected of doing something wrong, even though perhaps the person didn't actually do it outright, he has some connection to the act itself. And perhaps that you have some slight connection to Christianity. And Rabbi Eliezer replies, says, "Akiva, you've reminded me. I was once walking in the upper market of Tziporiv, Sepphoris. It was a major city in the Galilee. When I came across one Yaakov of Kfar Sechania by name. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the English term James, you know, the word James is Yaakov. And there's a question about which James this was, because, you know, James was a common name of many of those who were involved in the early church. Kfar Sechania was a town in Galilee. And he went on to deliver a drosha, and as he told him over a shtickel teira, and as he told him over an exposition of Torah that was taught to him by Yeshu. And he says, it's written in your Torah that you should not bring the hire of a harlot into the house of the Lord thy God. In other words, if, let's say, for a person as payment for a harlot, for a zona, gave a lamb, that lamb could not now be used by the harlot as a sacrifice. But could that money be applied to the erection of a Beis HaKiseh, in other words, of a bathroom? This is for the high priest. In other words, you want to use it in the construction of the temple itself. This is the question that this Christian asked Rabbi Eliezer. Eliezer did not reply, but he says, I'll tell you what Yeshu the Nazarene taught me. And he quoted a pasuk. He says, for the hire of the harlot, you've gathered up the money, and unto the hire of a harlot shall they return. They came from a place of filth, let them go to a place of filth. It's entirely proper that monies that were gained, that a harlot gained, that money should be used for toilet facilities. And Rabbi Elias says, you know, I like the chop, you know. It was a nice shtickel teira. I enjoyed it. Those words pleased me very much. And that's why I was arrested for apostasy, because I transgressed the scriptural words, harchek moleho drachecha, remove thy way far from her, the harlot, which is a parable referring to apostasy, to minus. I shouldn't have spoken to him. I shouldn't have gotten that close to him to enjoy his words. This incident, by the way, and this is really not, this goes beyond the parameters of this lecture. It's something we alluded to in the first lecture of this series on Shmuel HaKotan. The language of the original Talmud, the unexpunged Talmud, was that this Yaakov Kfar Sechania was a student, was a Talmud of Yeshu's. He was one of his students, the Nazarene students. And it would seem then that if a student of the Nazarene, of Yeshu, spoke to Rabbi Eliezer, then it would seem that Yeshu lived in a time which would correspond to the time of where the New Testament places him. According to the version that we've quoted, there's a Gemara in Sota. According to the Gemara in Sota, for the uncensored version, Mem Zion 47a, Yeshu HaNotzri, the Nazarene, was a disciple of Yeshua ben Prachya. And as he lived, Yeshua ben Prachya lived 100 years before the time that the New Testament places Yeshu. And we explain the historical problem. According to the Talmud, we find Yeshu dying about 100 years, being put to death some 100 years before the New Testament has that he's put to death. This version seems to imply, if he says, if he is truly this Yaakov, is really disciple of Yeshu, he is speaking to Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer lived at the time of destruction of the temple. As you remember, he was one of those last in the last lecture who Rabbi Eliezer carried out Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai from Yerushalayim prior to the destruction of the temple. It would seem that then this Yeshu then that they're referring to, this Nazarene, seems to have been. It would follow that he lived not in Yeshua ben Prachya's time, but rather in the time where the New Testament places him. Rav Yaakov Emden, because of this Gemara, Rav Yaakov Emden in his notes in the back of the Talmud, the Gemara in Avodah Zorah on 17a in Yud Zion, says perhaps there were two Yeshus. There were two people called Yeshu. Again, we touched upon it, you know, in the first lecture, but I just wanted to make you aware of the historical problem we see from this incident as well. That perhaps there were two people called Yeshu that perhaps carried a very similar message. Rabbi Eliezer not only dealt with students or with Christians, he was forced on occasion to leave Israel and to go to Rome and to deal with the Roman authorities. And here, as you see on page 5, this is D, and on page 6, E, and F, we have various incidents that he was traveling and went to Rome. I'd like to read with you, though, on page 6F, a fascinating incident. Instance which Rabbi Eliezer was involved really only slightly, but again gives us a sense of the period. I said on page 6 and F, there was an incident where Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, and Gamliel were in Rome. The Senate of the Emperor decreed that within 30 days there would be not a Jew left in the world. There was one senator, however, that feared Hashem, feared God. He came to Rabbi Gamliel, who, because Rabbi Gamliel was the nominal head of the Sanhedrin. So even though Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua perhaps greater than he in learning, Rabbi Gamliel as head of the Sanhedrin represented Jewry as a whole. He came to Rabbi Gamliel and revealed the plan to him. Our rabbis were very distressed by the matter. He, the senator, said to them, "Fear not." This is a non-Jew telling them this. "From now until the end of 30 days, you will see that the God of the Jews will stand by them. At the end of 25 days, and nothing had been done to revoke this decree, the senator revealed the matter to his wife. She said to him, 25 days are already over. He replied, "Well, there are 5 days left." Well, I guess he was thinking, you know, it's not over till it's over. I guess he was. His wife was even more righteous than he. She said to him, "Don't you have a ring that contains poison? You know, suck out the poison of the ring and you will die." It's important to note that the Romans had a general feeling that if a decree was passed, and shortly thereafter one of those who were involved on the decision, the voting of the decree, would die, They felt it was a bad omen, and therefore the decree was annulled. So in her waiting the 30 days, there was a dual, she had a dual plan. It was, well, when there's delay, you never know what will happen. And also the fact that the death itself would be something would cause them to reconsider the decree. He listened to her, sucked out the poison of the ring, and died. The rabbi heard about this occurrence that he died and went to visit his wife to console her by their presence. The rabbi said, "Woe is it to the ship that goes without paying duty?" Meaning to say that this tzaddik did not perform circumcision. He's going on to the other world, but not as a Jew. She replied, "I know what you're referring to. By your lives, the ship didn't pass until it gave its duty." Immediately she went to a closet, brought out a box that contained a foreskin that had been removed. On top of it were rags that were full of blood. That's to show that he had actually performed the circumcision prior to his death. Despite all that the Rebbe Eliezer had accomplished in his life, and he'd risen basically to the pinnacle of his Jewry. He eventually went on to marry the sister of Rabban Gamliel, who was the daughter of Rabban Shimon Gamliel, who was the one who had one of the ten, you know, the earliest of the ten martyrs. But there was an incident that changed all of this. And there's much to learn from this, and we're going to, it's on page 7 here. We all know, it's a Parsha in the Torah, it's a section of the Torah in Parsha Shemini, this is in Leviticus 11, that a earthenware vessel that becomes tome, that becomes ritually unclean, is permanently unclean. In other words, you can't take it to a mikveh, you can't do anything with this. There is a saying that perhaps it would be re-kilned, it would be redone, it would become anew, then it would be considered a new vessel, as if the old one disappeared, there's a new one in its place. But short of that, it is tome. When it comes in contact with tumah, not on the outside, but the thing which is ritually unclean, the dead animal, comes within the inside of this vessel, it renders the whole vessel unclean, ritually unclean. It applies to this thing to a earthenware pot. It applies to an earthenware oven. The ovens that were made then very often were conical ovens. They were removable. They would be 9 tefachim high or something. In other words, it would be like 30 inches or so high. And it would be wide at the bottom and it would slope up. And there would be a top to, you'd put a top to make sure that if you want at one point to keep all the heat. As you'd heat the oven, the smoke would rise, the vent would be open. And then you would remove the inside coals and close the top and keep the heat inside. There they used to bake their bread or put pots inside of it. There was a question, though, on what would be an abnormal earthenware oven, this conical oven. That it was really prepared in, this oven was really not your normal oven, but it had sections. And the sections were not, were put together by putting really, it was a, like a sand mixture, I guess it must have been sand plaster, you know, in between these sections, like these tiles, these round, if you could imagine these round conical sections. You put one, and then you'd put sand in between, you know, sand, plaster. Then you put another section, putting the sand again, then another section. And then they would all, then after this would be put together, there would be, I guess, mud that was put on the outside, which is commonly done to preserve, again, as an insulator to preserve the heat. And the question was, this kind of oven, is that we could look at it as one single unit. This is one large oven, and we know an earthenware oven, when it comes in contact with something tame, which is ritually impure, it will contaminate the whole oven. Or do we look at, it's really never an oven to begin with. It's just little pieces of ovens. Because every section by itself is really a non-oven. And we don't consider that the connection of these separate sections ever make a total oven. Because the sand in between makes it as if there's a separation between the various sections. So really we have three partial ovens instead of one whole oven. That was the discussion. There was a discussion between Rabbi Eliezer and the other Rabbonim, the other scholars, about this issue. Rabbi Eliezer's position is, we view these separate conical sections as just separate sections. We don't have one oven. And having and I don't know what it's not clear from a utilitarian, you know, point of view, what function does the sand place? And it's not clear, you know, if there is truly a function or not. And perhaps maybe it was just put there to avoid the issue of the tumah. In other words, the person would feel, you know, it would be best for me because of the problem of ritual impurity, and it was in a time when they were very sensitive with this, and in the time of the temple, it was very important for them to maintain all their vessels in a pure state. Perhaps this configuration was created and it's not that it really there was some sort of a use for it, that it was an improvement, but they just wanted to create a non-oven that would have the function of an oven, or close to it, but would not have the problems of contracting the tumah, you know, this impurity. But whatever the reason was, Rabbi Eliezer deemed that we do not view this as one complete oven, but just fragments of an oven, and therefore it does not contract tumah. It will never become ritually impure. The Chachomim took issue with this. The other scholars took issue with this. And it was called the Tanner Shel Achnoi. Achnoi is Aramaic for snake. They encompass it with arguments as a snake. And it was the snake that would go around. A snake would go around as a circle and put its tail in its mouth. It would be like a full circle. It was encircled with arguments. And it will continue on page 7. It has been taught on that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every imaginable argument, but they did not accept them. He said to them, this incident, and it seems if we accept this to be taken literally, is really unusual in Talmudic literature. Here we find the use of the supernatural in the decision process of halacha. It says, if the halacha agrees with me, Rabbi Eliezer, let this carob tree prove it. Thereupon the carob tree was torn 100 cubits, 100 amos out of its place, and others say it moved 400 cubits. And we're first going to read this and then analyze this. They replied, you can't bring any proof from a carob tree. Again, he says, if the halacha agrees with me, let this stream of water prove it. And the stream flowed backwards. And again, they replied, you can't bring any proof out of a stream of water. And then, again, he urged, he says, well, if the halacha agrees with me, let the walls of the school of the base medrash prove it. And the walls started to fall. Rabbi Yeshua rebuked them, and he says, when scholars are engaged, this is in halachic dispute, says you have no right to interfere. And the walls didn't fall in honor of Rabbi Yeshua, but they didn't resume their upright position in honor of Rabbi Eliezer. And evidently they're saying that that base medrash, if we understand this literally, is still standing. That base medrash was still standing in that inclined position. And then Rabbi Eliezer again wanted to prove his point, and he says, if the Allah agrees with me, let it be proof from heaven. Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out. He says, how could you argue with Rabbi Eliezer? He says, in all matters in halacha, this is halacha kamoisa, the halacha agrees with him in every place. So there was a heavenly voice that came out. Like there, we saw three miracles and a heavenly voice came out, says, we should rule like Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Yeshua rose and exclaimed, says, the Torah is not in heaven. So the Torah has already been given at Mount Sinai. If there's a question in halacha, it has to be logically understood by the scholars of the generation with the tools that they are given. And we pay no attention to a heavenly voice. Halacha is given to us to decide. It's not in heaven's hands. And therefore, and since we are deciding this, the halacha must go with the majority. It continues on the Gemara on page 8. Rabbi Nosson met Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu the prophet asked him, what did the Holy One Blessed He do in that hour? He laughed, he replied, saying, my sons have defeated me. In other words, I tried, again, weftness means literally or it's allegorically, but you know, basically it's saying like, I tried my best, but they won. And as the colleagues of Rabbi Eliezer have defeated me. This incident is very difficult to understand. First of all, what is meant by the symbolism of the carob tree, of the stream of water, the walls of the base medrash of the study hall? What was the purpose of this voice from heaven, especially if we don't rule like it? So why is heaven interfering in the first place? These are all areas which the various commentators deal with. I'd like to share you at least one commentary the combination of them that I felt had a particular sense here. If we see from Rabbi Eliezer's early life, it was a life when he started learning of deprivation. The carob tree symbolizes a very Spartan way of living. Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, the great saint of that generation, was said that he ate a kav. In other words, a kav would be the equivalent of 16 kiddush cups. In other words, it would be like a quart. It would be half a gallon of carob a whole week. But that's all he lived on. It says when Rushim Bar Yochoi was hiding from the Romans, and he hid in a cave, he lived on the fruit of a carob tree. The carob tree really expressed the idea of studying Torah in an atmosphere that despises luxuries. And perhaps, as he was saying, says, Rabbi Eliezer was proving, why should the majority, or why should they reconsider, or why should I think Rabbi Eliezer should be right? Rabbi Eliezer considered himself head and shoulders above those of his generation, just like Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, his teacher. And he maintained that they should consider being mevatel, their das, in other words, that they should consider ruling like him simply because of his personal greatness. the showing of the carob tree and this miraculous showing was in a sense saying that he who lived this life of deprivation grew to be the scholar that one should look up to and follow. And that was the symbol why the carob tree moved. The purpose of the hundred is here we find the story of Rabbi Eliezer, who's the first one in the study hall in the morning, the last one out of the study hall. There's a Gemara in Chagiga in Tesomet Beis in 9b that describes how many times should one review a subject. And he says, at least 100. And if you review it 101, it's Eina Doma, it's basically a new, it's far more significant to do it 101 times than even 100 times. The 100 cubits symbolized his diligence. He went over it 100 times. The 400 amos, and there's the other version, perhaps, again, I'm quoting one of the commentators, alludes to that there's a Gemara in Erevin in Nundalat Amud Beis in 54b. This is Rabbi Preda used to teach a student that had a very hard time studying 400 times. Now, there's either the number 100 or the number 400. Refers to his diligence. So again, he was saying he learned Torah mitoch adchak. He learned because of through scarcity, through deprivation. He put so much effort into Torah, therefore his opinion should be followed. They were not impressed. And then he pointed to the Amos Hamayim, to the water. There's a Gemara in Tainis and Zion Omer Aleph that explains why is the Torah likened to water? Because water flows downwards. The Torah rests on he who is most humble. And then the water flowing backwards, in other words, showing us that that God controls the flow of water, so to speak, was an indication again of Rabbi Eliezer's stature, that he is the one that the Torah flows to. They were not impressed. And then he took the walls of the study hall, the walls of the Beis Medrash. You have to realize he never left. He's the first one in, first one out. Last one out says, says he's always there, just by virtue of being with the yeshiva, being with the Talmidim. He's gained much greater insight than his colleagues, and therefore they should rule like him. They were not impressed. And then finally, after all these miracles, a voice came out of heaven and saying explicitly, we should rule like Rabbi Eliezer. They're a bunch of litvaks, you know what I mean? they just were not impressed by all these miracles. The Shita Mekubetzos offers the opinion of Rav Nissen Gaon, one of the early Rishonim, in saying that Rabbi Eliezer's colleagues just view this like a test, like when a false prophet comes and shows all kinds of signs. We don't listen to signs. They were convinced this is not the way halacha should be, is ruled, and they felt Rabbi Eliezer may be first amongst equals, but he is just one of them, and we rule with the majority. And it was on that basis they felt that they were not impressed, and the halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer, and he should bend his will. I mean, when there's a final vote, he should bend his will to the majority. There are those who would like to offer just a further comment to this. Rabbi Eliezer, besides being a student of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, was a student of the House of Shammai. We'll quote this a little later on. He was Shmutihu.
He was a member of the House of Shammai. The House of Shammai similarly did not bend to the will of the majority of Beis Hillel.
Yeah.
Hillel's students were more numerous than Shammai's. The difference being that Hillel's students were not as sharp as Shammai's. Shammai's were mechadidi tfei, were sharper. And therefore, Shammai's students felt that numbers mean nothing when we have basically two groups which are unequal. Amongst equals, numbers mean something. Here the Torah says, Acher Rabim Lahatas, we go after the majority. But those of Shammai felt that they were in a league of their own. It was a difference of kind. And therefore the laws of majority did not apply to them. And perhaps Rav Eliezer felt the same way. Whatever it was, Rav Eliezer did not bend to the majority after all was after all of this was all this these so-called proofs were offered. They were not impressed, and after all was said and done, he still maintained that he was right. And according to the view of the majority, Rabbi Eliezer's position was really untenable. Because after the vote is taken, even though maybe in God's eyes this was the original Torah that was given to Moshe, but since the Torah was given to our understanding and we didn't stand on Mount Sinai, we did not hear directly what the halacha was regarding this particular oven, we have to go with the majority. And they felt Rabbi Eliezer to be in contempt of court. And he who is in contempt of court is put in excommunication. And they excommunicated Rabbi Eliezer. And the Gemara goes on, and the time is late, to go through all the details, and you could look at it yourselves on page 8. But they actually did put Rabbi Eliezer into Cherem. That's some form of excommunication. There are different levels. There's Nidui and there's Cherem. And there's a question, Cherem is the most severe form, and there's a question amongst the commentaries what form this took. And even after he was excommunicated, Rabbi Eliezer still did not recant. But there's a fascinating incident which was recorded in the Yerushalmi in Moed Kot on page 9. But once Rabbi Eliezer was walking, this is in B, the first paragraph, was walking the marketplace and saw a woman as she was washing the floor of her house. She then took the dirty water and threw it out onto the street and happened to land on Rabbi Eliezer's head. Now this is really insult to injury. In other words, after he had this, you can imagine him after all his, being traumatized by this incident and then having this land on his head. He remarked, "It seems to me that my colleagues will now reinstate me, as is written, Ma'ashbois Yorim Evyon, from the dung heaps he lifts up the destitute, that I've undergone, I've undergone all these indignities, that they'll release me from my, that I've suffered enough. But yet since on the key point, he'd not bend to the rule of the majority, they still maintained the cherem. They still maintained the nidui, the excommunication. Just another, and perhaps just to give us again another view of his life. On page 9, we have in paragraph D, we quote, as we said before, that he was Shemuti, which the Bali Tosfos, the members of the Tosfos, maintain that he was a disciple of the House of Shammai, besides being a disciple of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's. On page 10,
There's a Gemara in Tainus. Another story said about Rabbi Eliezer, and there was a drought, and they declared a fast day, and it was a prolonged drought. And he went in front of the Holy Ark, and he said the 24 blessings, there's a special blessings that are said, there's extra blessings that were added to the Shemone Esrei, to the regular prayers in times of drought, and was not answered. Rabbi Akiva went before the Ark and said, Avinu Malkeinu, this is the source of Avinu Malkeinu, by the way, our Father, our King, we have no other King before you. Our Father, our King, for your sake, Lamancha, says, have pity on us. When he said that, the rains came down. The rabbi suspected, this incident, of course, happened before the time he was excommunicated. The rabbi suspected Rabbi Eliezer as not being a true tzaddik. A heavenly voice came out and said, not because this one, Rabbi Akiva, is greater than the other, Rabbi Eliezer, but because this one, Rabbi Akiva, has forbearance. The language of the thing is Mavral Midoisov. In other words, he forgives others. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, commenting on the difference between Shammai and Hillel, and Hillel representing love and giving, and Shammai representing kabdonus, strictness, explains that Shammai's approach was one of choice. It wasn't that just that Hillel was born with a kind attitude, and Chas v'Shalom Shammai was born with a mean streak, and that's why Shammai seems to have that type of an attitude. Their midos, their character traits were a product of a rational decision which was made on their part as how should a leader or how should a scholar conduct himself. In Europe, just recently, we find also two molds, two types of rabbonim, two types of rabbis. There were those who were aristocrats, who were very careful about their honor, because their honor represented the honor of the Torah. Whereas the Gemara describes, as the Gemara in Tainus, in Gimel and Beis, in 3b and 4a, Kol Talmud Chacham Sheina Kosha Kabarzel Eina Talmud Chacham. A scholar is not as hard as iron, is not a scholar. Was to make sure that no one slights his honor, meaning the honor of the Torah. And there were others that were more forgiving and more giving and did not focus on the honor of the Torah. And there were really two approaches. Hillel maintained that the approach in his generation was the approach of love. Hevi mitalmida shel Aaron. One should be like Aaron. But Hillel realized that when Aaron, which was the model for the way his life led, when Aaron was alive, Aaron had a colleague called Moshe. And Moshe says, felt the yoke of Hadina Sahor, the law should pierce through mountains. Moses was for structure, for law. Aaron was for love. There were really two forces, two streams. Hillel chose to be from the Talmidim of the disciples of Aaron. It was a conscious choice. He felt in that generation, that's the way one should go. Shammai disagreed. It was a disagreement, just like many of the other disagreements that scholars have, that Shammai and Hillel had. It was a degree, how should one conduct himself? It wasn't that Shammai was mean. It was this is the way he felt that a Rav, that a Rosh Hashiva should act. He should be Moshe. That same argument, it would seem, would be between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer.
As we stated before, Rabbi Eliezer was a descendant of Moshe's. And that's why he wasn't Mavro Midosov. He was Kosher Kabarzel. He was Din. He felt this is the way it should be. The honor of the Torah has been trampled to such an extent that one has to stand up and one has to be firm. Rabbi Akiva felt that the approach of Hillel was correct. And therefore, and this is what the heavenly voice said, it isn't one is greater than the other. There are two approaches. However, when one prays, one is asking for mercy. And when one is asking for mercy, one could only deserve mercy if one is merciful in his own life. It's mida keneged mida. Rabbi Akiva showed mercy, showed forgiveness. He was Mavro Midosov, so Hashem reflected that back to him and showed mercy, and the rain came. Rabbi Eliezer did not conduct himself with that midah, with that attribute. And therefore, says that reflection, in other words, the midah, the mercy did not come back to someone who did not act merciful. Rabbi Eliezer maintained that in his generation, mercy should not be the predominant attribute. But it was at a cost. If you don't act with mercy, you can't expect mercy back. Rabbi Akiva gave to others, he was given in return. But perhaps it gives us an inkling as to the character of Rabbi Eliezer, and perhaps why Rabbi Eliezer also was so unbending in the argument. He felt there was a question of the covet of the Torah itself. He felt he was the greatest of his generation. And he felt it was a slight of the Torah that the others should not recognize it. On page 10, and the time doesn't allow it, just you can look at your own time. Before Rabbi Eliezer died, students came to him and asked him for direction. He told them several things. Be careful of the honor of your friends, of your colleagues. Restrain your children from excessive study of Scripture, the literal interpretation of Scripture. Just to detriment of the study of Mishnah, the Talmud, and the oral law. Set your children at the knees of Talmudic scholars, that they should have an intimate relationship with Talmudic scholars. And also when praying, know before whom you are standing. This statement, by the way, du lifnei miyata omdim, or da lifnei miyata omdim, was taken as a common expression. You find many shuls, you'll find that expression, know from whom you're, it's taken from the advice he gave before he died. And because of these things, you will merit the world to come. Before he died, evidently his, not just his minor disciples, but his former colleagues and disciples came to him. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah. They came to Rabbi Eliezer. And right before he died, this is on page 11, you could read this yourself. He was bemoaning the fact that he had studied so much from his teachers, and yet in comparison, it was like a, as he says, is like a dog lapping at a lake. How little water can the dog extract from the lake? How little. His students, in turn, only took from him they used to have a salve that used to go by the eyes, and there used to be a dabber that used to be, he said, the as much salve that would go on this little dabber as it would go inside the salve, just that little bit that would go into the eye. So the comparison that taken from the dabber to what's left in the, in the container is what my students took from me. I once heard a beautiful explanation as well, that the difference between the dog lapping from the lake and taking from the dabber is not just a question of amount. Well, you know, there's a much smaller percentage which is taken, a dog takes, than what's taken from, extracted from the ISAF. But there's a basic difference as well. The dog, when he's thirsty, thinks he's going to drink up the whole lake. Well, after a little while, he realizes he won't do it. But at least he has the vision that he's going to drink this whole lake up. In applying ISAV, you know you're not going to apply too much. Even when you start, you know I'm just going to take a little bit. The difference between me and my students is when I studied by my Rebbe, I thought I'm going to learn all the Torah from him. Unfortunately, I didn't. But at least I had that desire. My students don't even have that desire. He goes on to explain all the information that he knows no one accessed, and are going to go by with him as he died. His students asked him a question also of ritual cleanliness. His reply was, "Tohor, what you've asked me is clean." Those were the last words that crossed his lips, and with those words he died. And Chazal commented on his death. This is when Rabbi Eliezer died. This is in the Yerushalmin Sota. This is Nigna Sefer HaChochma. The book of wisdom was hidden. And there was all that knowledge went with him. In 2 weeks, in the next lecture, we're going through the life of Rabbi Yeshua, the colleague of Rabbi Eliezer. Are there any questions? Yes. Because of the time, I did not. Let me go over this. Let me go over the passage on page 8. Rabbi Eliezer, you can imagine the situation. Rabbi Eliezer, the greatest of his generation, being excommunicated. All that happened afterwards, the proceedings in the yeshiva in Yavna, he was excluded from. He was a very bitter person. And in all arguments, in all that perhaps, again, one only can speculate, even though the scholars meant L'shem Shemayim, they meant for heaven's sake, but they did cause tremendous hurt on Rabbi Eliezer's part. Rabbi Eliezer's wife was afraid that if he would fall on his face to say Tachanun, his cries would be heard, and that the justice would be done for his honor. Perhaps there wasn't enough done to cushion the blow, or whatever, what slight misdemeanor was done on the part of his colleagues, who felt that they had to do this thing, but they would be taken to task. So if Rabbi Eliezer would pray and cry for his situation, Rabbi Eliezer's colleagues would suffer. So his wife was very careful whenever he davened Shemon Esrei, when he davened, that he would not say Tachanun, that he would not fall on his face. And as the commentators explain, there's a Rajba that says that after Shemon Esrei, before you say Tachanun, you're not allowed to talk. Because the Tachanun merges, and it's falling on your face, and merges with the Shemon Esrei. So she always made sure that after she would ask him a question, she would do something that he would talk. He wouldn't say Tachanun, you know, and if he doesn't say it immediately, he wouldn't say it afterwards. One day she made a mistake and thought that day was Rosh Chodesh. On the new moon, one does not say Tachanun.
let's say Semites, you say Halom, and so simply don't say Talmud. She made a mistake. It was not the new moon. She went to answer the door. She went to give bread to a poor person. In the interim, Rabbi Eliezer was not disturbed, knew the truth. It was not Rosh Chodesh, fell on his face. And as it says, when he got up, as he says, she says, you can get up now because you've killed my brother. Rabban Gamliel, the head of the Sanhedrin, who was under his auspices that they put the brother-in-law in excommunication, was the brother of Rabbi Eliezer's wife. He says, you've killed my brother. He says, and shortly afterwards, the announcement came out that actually he had just died right after he said Tachnun. And he asked, how do you know this? He says, I have a tradition of my father's house. Says, all gates in heaven are locked except the gates of wounded feelings. God hears the cries of people who are wounded. Who are hurt. And that's why, but that's the meaning of that passage. Any other questions? It's very difficult to really ascertain. We can only speculate. However, I didn't want to get into the nitty gritty and the historical questions here. If you notice, we can just have some sense of this. On page 6, on paragraph E, so there was an incident with Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua when they traveled across the Mediterranean Sea. When they arrived at Rome, Hadrian, may his bones be crushed, said to them, the Roman Emperor Hadrian became emperor, it was probably in the year 119. Before he became emperor, though, he was groomed. He was an adopted son. He was groomed by Trajan, who was then the emperor. So it's hard to know that he go together with Rabbi Yeshua after Hadrian became emperor, or in the years prior when he had position of power, but he was not yet emperor. But we're dealing with a time when at least Trajan was emperor. Trajan became emperor in the year 98. Since Hadrian was just a little boy when he became emperor, so we're getting in the year, somewhere in the hundreds. If we accept this text, it's because always we have every text. We have Rabbi Eliezer. We're never sure. Maybe is that the correct thing? Or maybe delete the Yud, it's Rabbi Eliezer, and it would be Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah. Because there are errors in these texts. If this text is correct, as Rabbi Eliezer, then we would place this incident somewhere between the year 100 and the year 120. In that era, there's a statement attributed to Rabbi Eliezer in the tractate Gittin. There's a saying in 58a, is that he describing Betar. This is, we know Betar was destroyed in the year 135, describing how there was a whole stream of blood. It was a good portion of the stream got filled with blood from all those that were massacred at Betar. So if the text is correct, he lived until the year at least 135. So we have him together with Rabbi Yeshua prior to excommunication, some 30 years, at least before his death.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.